Today's guest is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, known worldwide as America's Rabbi. He is a noted rabbinic scholar, popular international speaker, and best-selling author. He hosts the Rabbi Daniel Lappin podcast and for many years co-hosted the Ancient Jewish Wisdom TV show on the TCT Network with his wife, Susan. He is one of America's most eloquent speakers, and his ability to extract life principles from the Bible and transmit them in an entertaining manner, thus improving people's finances, family, and community life, has brought countless numbers of Jews and Christians closer to their respective faiths. Pairing his inheritance as a descendant of a multi-generational rabbinical family with his background in science and business, he teaches ancient Jewish wisdom in an unparalleled manner. Rabbi Daniel and Susan Lappin coined the phrase ancient Jewish wisdom to describe the oral transmission first conveyed from God to Moses at Mount Sinai. This transmission has been faithfully passed down through the generations, and much of it is revealed in the original Hebrew of the Torah. Through his teachings, Rabbi Lappin provides access to all who wish to benefit from this treasure trove. Enjoy the show. Rabbi Lappin, thank you so much for coming on the Jason Wright Show. How are you, sir?
Couldn't be better, thank you, Jason. And I'm so happy to be here with you after having listened to some of your wonderful shows in the past.
Well, you're very kind. And one of the things that we mentioned briefly offline is the motto for my show is to improve always and always. And I think that's why our mutual friend, James Quandall, suggested, he's like, you have got to get the rabbi on. It would be a fantastic, just knowing the two of you. And James has followed you longer than me. He's the one who actually introduced me to your work. And I was like, yes, James, wonderful suggestion. And the reason being is because, Rabbi, you focus so much of your work on this holistic approach to who we are as humans. Yes. And it's not just about financial success, but it's not just about spiritual success. It's also about happiness, joy, health, wealth, the entire thing. So with that said, just kind of give this audience a sense of who you are, your background, and then I'm just going to ask a purely curious question to you. How does one become a rabbi? I know nothing about it other than, you know, obviously I read the word every single morning. I do read the Old Testament. It's so, but, you know, and so I have some idea, but kind of explain as part of your Genesis story, how you became a rabbi.
Well, the short answer is you don't. It's not a good profession. it kind of depends. A rabbi doesn't necessarily mean somebody who leads a congregation. The word just means teacher.
Right.
And I come from a line of rabbis, my father and all the way back, as far as I know. So it naturally, James, led to a point that I knew after sort of growing up in a rabbi's house and studying with a grandparent, grandfathers and uncles and so on, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, Jason, that the one thing I absolutely never would be is a rabbi.
Really? And so what changed?
What changed is that sometimes when something lies ahead in your destiny and you try and evade it, the good Lord whacks you and until you get the message. And if necessary, he'll use a 2x4. So I eventually, I saw that what I was doing was that anyway. And the reason was because of this, Jason, that I realized I was uniquely positioned to answer the question that I had been asked again and again and again, which is, why are Jews so disproportionately good with money? Mm. And so I realized that only a rabbi could answer that without being accused of bigotry. And not that it did insulate me in the end anyways, but the bottom line is it's a fantastically good question. And the important thing to understand is, you know, in order to succeed financially, do you have to be circumcised as a Jew? And if the answer is yes, then many men would prefer poverty, I think. I had to find out what was responsible for this, because when you get right down to it, after all, Jews constitute about one, little less than 1.5% of America's population. And so on the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans, Jews should be about 6 or 7 people at most. But the truth is that Jews are never fewer than 25 and usually closer to 100. So very, very disproportionately represented among the ranks of the financially successful. And I had to find out the answer. And when I did find out the answer and wrote a book about it and did a lot of lecturing on it all around the world, it boiled down to the fact that you didn't have to be Jewish, you didn't have to be born Jewish, you didn't have to become Jewish, but that there were certain fundamental principles that were deeply ingrained, more among Jews than anywhere else, for reasons I can talk about. And so there I found myself doing what the word rabbi means, which is teacher. And even though I spent a certain amount of time earning my living as an electrical engineer, my father did insist that I attended a Bible seminary for many years and become absolutely familiar with not only biblical texts, but many texts of ancient Jewish wisdom, all of which led to many of the insights and understandings about living and about money and about the role of money that became part of what I became best known for. So that's the short story.
One of the things that immediately leaps to mind is that you talk a lot about asking that very fundamental question, why? What is it about Jews that have led to the stereotypes, especially as it relates to finances? And we live in a time now where it's not, and the thing is, let me back up a little bit. If you look at the Jewish faith, and from what I understand about it, because there are also some numbers to the contrary to that, you say that Jewish members of the Forbes list are disproportionately represented. Also, highly underrepresented in prisons are Jews. Also, highly underrepresented in divorce are the Jewish people. Also, very highly represented in procreation, number of children, replacing the birth rate, having families are the Jewish people. So all these things that once upon a time we held as fundamental behaviors for success are now so demonized. Now, and it's not just amongst, because now it's slipped from, it used to be this, and again, if I am wrong about any of this, say, Jason, shut up, you know what you're talking about, and I can take it. My ego is not attached to anything I say. But what I see now is that has moved from, okay, instead of making the snide and stereotypical remarks about Jewish behaviors that have led to success, it's now called white supremacy. It's now called anyone that has pursued success and is looked to based on these things that you've talked about. And what I want to really unpack, because I'm hoping this conversation today will be one of, I want this audience to understand from you, how do you put these principles into effect that are universal? You came about them by exploring the Jewish faith and understanding, oh, so that's why we do those things. That's why I had to sit down at a very young age and learn how to not spend more money than I actually make. The saving is a good thing, and having a family and not having premarital sex and all the like. That's why those things became part of our culture. And I'm hoping that this audience will understand that, again, you don't have to be circumcised to practice these principles and to be successful. So with kind of that, I want to get to your take on why we're seeing that shift to where, I guess, discipline and prudence is being so demonized in our culture, and ill behavior, or what used to be considered ill behavior, bad health, bad finances, blowing money you don't have, just doing things for the Instagram, why that is being so celebrated. But more than anything, let's start with just some basic principles for financial success, because I know that's probably of all the things that you're known for in your teaching, that seems to be the big one, you know. Is you understand money, but also you know how to put it into terms for the everyday person. Just follow these principles and you too can have financial freedom and success. So let's start there. What are just some of the basic principles that you would impart to someone to get them on sound financial footing?
Well, let me tell you that From time to time, and I know you're not doing this, Jason, but from time to time, people say to me, what is the one most important secret to successful marriage? Because I do a lot of teaching on male-female relationships. And the answer is, here is, I'm about to tell you the one really big secret about successful marriage. And the big secret is that there is no one big secret. That is the secret. Nothing as complex and at one and the same time with the potential for both pain and pleasure as it is can possibly be reduced to a single slogan. And I have exactly the same thing. People sometimes say, okay, fine. So, you know, you've written all these books about money and success and so on. And the great thing about this approach, I should mention parenthetically, is that it's not based on my success. You see, if you read a book by Warren Buffett about financial success, that really is only helpful if you happen to have Warren Buffett's IQ, which is probably well over 130 or 40, and if you happen to have a few tens of millions of dollars handy to invest, you know, or if you read Bill Gates's book on success, again, really useful if you had a mom who was on the board of directors of IBM and a dad who was a well-known international lawyer, and you dropped out of Harvard on the cusp of the computer revolution. All of that would be really useful. But how does that help ordinary folks? And it's important to note that the secrets of ancient Jewish wisdom on money do not come from my own personal success or any other individual, but they come from the greatest longitudinal study of human endeavor ever found in the history of humanity. And that is, it's a 2,000-year-old story of how Jews have disproportionately succeeded in business, in good times and in bad, in hospitable and generous and wonderful countries, as well as in oppressive tyrannies. Men and women of every color and every approach, unified by only one thing, and that is by a set of beliefs. And so the question was, you know, could this set of beliefs be reduced into a set of techniques and tips and tools and techniques? And the answer is yes, usable by absolutely everybody. And so some of the important ideas are, number one, one has to get rid of the idea that making money is somehow reprehensible morally, that somehow you are expressing your innate lower level tendency towards greed. Now, this is very widely spread. And as a matter of fact, we've had literally decades of indoctrination that the rich guy is the bad guy. You know, you have politicians to the present week using phrases like, the rich must pay their fair share. That fails to define what rich means. It also fails to define what fair means. And more than anything else, it proclaims that some politician is getting his grubby fingers into your wallet just a little deeper than they were before already. But people use that. And so the implication is the rich are probably not paying their fair share. They found some kind of skullduggery that allows them to evade their social responsibility of paying their fair. People get indoctrinated by this kind of thing. Or you think about the villain. If you check a primetime television as well as the top-rated movies, who are the villains? Who commit most murders?
Oh, it's always the rich white guy, the rich business guy.
It's not the poor ghetto black who's depicted. It is the rich white guy who is always the evil villain, every single time.
Right.
Look, there's a reason that companies, car companies, food companies spend incalculable sums of money on advertising. And that is, it doesn't mean that everyone who sees an advertisement for a BMW is going to run out and buy one. But it means that enough people are impacted little by little, again and again and again, by multiple repetitions to adjust their thinking so that if and when they're ready to buy a car, they are now seriously going to consider the BMW that they never would have before. That's what happens. That's how repetition works. It's why political advertising works. People who have been shown to know literally nothing about a candidate and his genuine positions and his genuine track record will vote for a candidate based on the advertising paid for by that candidate's campaign in the first place. People are impacted by what they hear. And so, you see the scene repeated every year as the academic year draws to a close, 1,000 times in schools around the country, where the teacher says, you know, what are your goals? What would you like to do? And, the 16-year-old girl says, you know, I want to become an environmental engineer and give people clean air and clean, you know, and somebody else says, I want to become a teacher and put children on the escalator to success. And, you know, everybody applauds all these wonderful things. I want to serve the public good and I want to go into politics to do good. Everybody loves it. And then, you know, child gets up and says, I'd like to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30 by building a successful business that employs thousands of people and provides the goods and services that millions of people want. Dead silence, maybe even boos.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of ambition is that to become a millionaire? And so one of the very important things is beginning to understand that there are only two categories of people who can take your money by force: armed thugs and the government.
And it's interesting. I want to ask you a question, or just kind of make a point right there. What's interesting that you said the government. A lot of the people that it's okay that they're wealthy are politicians. It is amazing to me. We live in a time where, like you said, the kid that stands up and says, I want to be a millionaire. I want to be the CEO of a company. I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to discover something incredible. They are, you know, besmirched. They're, you know, that's not a noble endeavor. Yet if I'm like our current president and I am by all typical standards, wealthy, multiple homes, multiple million net worth, and I've been a public servant my whole life, then instead of that raising a red flag, how can you become wealthy being a public servant? You've never created anything. You've never created product. You've never created service. You're wealthy, but that's okay. We like
you. Now, Jason, don't forget to add in that when you entered public service, your public financial statements showed, you know, a net worth of a few thousand dollars.
Exactly.
And 20 years later, as you say, you're worth multiple millions, all on a public service salary. It's a miracle.
Right.
Yes, you know, talking of somebody who's in the news a little bit, mm-hmm. It so happens, you've heard of one of the largest banks. Today it's been absorbed and become the credit card arm of Bank of America. But MBNA Bank, mm-hmm. based in Delaware, was really, they pioneered the affiliate credit card business. And it became one of the biggest banks in the world. Exactly 20 years ago, the U.S. Senate was working on bankruptcy legislation that was going to make it even easier for people to get out of credit card debt. And at that point, MBNA hired a gentleman known as Hunter Biden, if that name rings a bell.
Heard that somewhere.
And at the time, guess who was chairing the committee in the Senate working on the bankruptcy legislation? A senator called Joe Biden. And soon after this, after 2 or 3 years of being on the MBNA payroll, the Senate canceled that legislation, colluded with MBNA to make it more difficult for people to escape credit card debt by declaring bankruptcy. So there is a simple snapshot of exactly how that process goes through. But nobody criticizes the wealth of politicians. nobody criticizes the wealth of movie stars and sports heroes. But, and one of the reasons that is because everybody understands that they cannot quarterback a National Football League team and take the ball faster down the field than anybody else. People kind of intuitively know they can't do it. And they say, well, yeah, I guess that quarterback deserves his big bucks. Or they know that they don't look like Brad Pitt or I forget.
What's the name?
Sydney Sweeney.
Oh, okay.
The newest, yeah. People kind of know they don't look like that. And so, yeah, kind of understand. But people have no understanding. And I believe that it's no accident that one of the most important topics on which high school graduates leave 12 years of education utterly clueless about is money and finance. They're not even capable of running their own budgets. It's very helpful to keep a population ignorant on money and finance.
Yeah, see, that's the thing that just that baffles me. I was reading, I saw a real quick clip, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, Robert Reich, was he the labor secretary under Clinton? Yeah, an economist. And he was bashing Jeff Bezos for how little his tax rate was and the fact that he deserved to be paying a wealth tax.
Yeah, of course.
I rarely get into politics publicly. I keep them to myself. I'm very interested and I've always been active, but you know, it's rare that I respond, but I couldn't let that one go without, I fell for it. But my question to him, and it wasn't to be inflammatory or anything, but I was like, why would you attack someone that has, let's look at you as an economist versus Jeff Bezos. Which one has done the greater good, as people like Robert Reich like to talk about? Which one has done the greater good for more people? And, you know, first of all, look at the number of taxpayers that Amazon has created. Okay, maybe irregardless of Jeff Bezos's tax rate, personally, that is such a ridiculous standard to measure that by, considering the number of taxpayers he's created. How about during the pandemic, whenever about one of the only ways we could get goods and services was due to the logistical miracle that is Amazon?
Yeah, sure.
So,
except again, the thing to say to Robert Wright is, if he is evading taxes illegally, send the IRS after him. And if he's not, leave him alone and go to Congress. But what you are doing is just virtue signaling and trying to get your name into the press. So all of these things, I mean, you know, we've just flirted around one tiny aspect of it, which is understanding that if you're not the government and you're not an armed thug, the only way that you can have money transferred from other people's pockets into yours is by providing them with goods or services that are worth more to them than the money you're asking for in exchange. There is no other way. And so that, the idea, again, you'll have heard this enough times to know that it again has indoctrinated people. Have you ever heard people people say about a charitable philanthropist makes a big donation to something or other, and everybody says how wonderful to see him giving back to society?
Right.
What does that imply that he was doing to society while he was making the money in the first place?
Obviously taking, not working, not giving, but must have been taking something.
Obviously, because in the final analysis, we all know that nobody can truly succeed at anything that deep in his heart he considers to be morally reprehensible.
Right.
And so one of the very early steps is understanding that. Now, it's also true that people have come to believe that that money is the most important thing in achieving happiness. And several studies in the last 5 years have actually shown an increase in the number of people who believe that the first and most important priority is making money. But anybody who's really thoughtful about that knows that relationships with other people are actually more important. Making money does not guarantee relationships with other people. Relationships with other people do put you in a position of being able to make more money. So there's no question that those two belong together. And so another secret of ancient Jewish wisdom on this topic, beyond realizing that making money is in itself virtuous, you're not a pirate like the 16th century, where after a lengthy career of raping and robbing and pillaging and plundering, you build a cathedral to pay your way back into polite society. That's not what business has to do. By making money in the first place, that in itself shows you've delivered value to society. As you said earlier, Jason, Robert Reich, the economist, cannot show that. Politicians cannot show that. But somebody who's made a lot of money, honestly, in a free market, has demonstrated that enough people have derived value by what he delivers. And so in addition to that is also the tremendously important concept, which is that one has to focus on multiple avenues of self-development. If you focus on money alone, your likelihood of achieving it is very, very low. There are a few outliers, particularly between about 2000 and now. There's a small number of high-tech entrepreneurs, of people who did almost nothing else in their lives except sitting and coding and becoming early shareholders in organizations that grew. The numbers are very low. They're very much against you. So in terms of realistic assessment, it turns out that the full dose of human happiness comes from success in five areas. And the five areas are family, which means all relationships that have been created by a sexual relationship. So in other words, when you get together with relatives on Thanksgiving, the reason that you have uncles and aunts and cousins is because many years ago, grandpa and grandma found ecstasy together. That's the reason. And so family, with all its implications and all its meanings and all its activities and all its roles, is one of the five important areas. Another one is fitness, physical health. That's really important. And there are things you can do to increase the likelihood of physical health. Again, to some extent, it's the ovarian lottery. Some people win it, some people lose it. But to the extent that you've been dealt a card in the health area, you can maximize it in certain ways. And again, focusing only on making money means that even if you succeed, you're probably not going to be able to do it for very long. So, I mean, obviously, you've got to focus on physical fitness as well. Now, family and physical fitness is not the only two. There's a third F, and that is friendship. One needs connections, social connections. All connections that do not fit into family and do not fit under finance. In other words, if I belong to a political party, if I'm part of a sports club, if I'm part of a civic group like the Rotary Club, whatever it is, all of those relationships are really important. And as a matter of fact, as Malcolm Gladwell in The Tipping Point popularized, something which has been well known for many years, which is that the strongest correlation between financial success is the number of friends you have. It's really, really important.
Can I ask you a question about that point? Because I think it is one that, as I look back on my life, I realize now more than ever, like also there's the adage that we are the average of the five people we spend the most time with. If you spend the time with people who are prudent with their finances, that are healthy, then you're more likely to be healthy. When it comes to curating, for lack of a better word, the friends that you're going to spend the most time with, how important is it to cut out those people that don't bring
And when I, to say bring value sounds transactional, and I don't mean it that way. I'm a very relational person, but I mean people that either because of their habits, their worldview, the way they view money, it just
the simple way to describe it, Jason. What you're heading towards is make friends with people who share your values.
Okay, very good.
Obviously, yeah.
And that goes back to why the community is so important, correct?
No, it really is. And so, you know, for a married couple to hang out with a lot of divorced individuals is a really dumb idea.
Right.
So not because it's going to make you, but it does impact you in, you know, a thousand little taps achieve more than one big blow. And one has to be aware of that, whether you're in advertising or hanging out. So, yes, the five Fs are your family, your fitness, your friendships, in other words, and your finances. And finances don't mean just your bank account. It means your possessions. It means your investments. It means your everything that is a part of what makes you feel enlarged. It includes your finances, but it also includes your financial relationships. Now, you know, do you necessarily make money from your friends? No, that's not the exact idea. It's that relationships lead to transactions. And so you will, if you go to a Jewish wedding or a Jewish bar mitzvah and ask questions, talk to people, you will find again and again and again that overwhelmingly large numbers of guests are friends because of an original business relationship. So doing business with friends isn't the point, but making friends out of those with whom you do business is. And I've only told you four of the five F's so far. I've told you about family, and I've told you about friendships, and I've told you about physical fitness, and I've told you about finance. And the fifth one is faith. And in the category of faith, I really should have made that category spiritual, but spiritual doesn't start with an F. It starts with an S, and we wanted the alliteration value of five Fs. Focus on your five Fs, see? And so faith includes the spiritual. And if you want to understand the link between faith and finance, just think about how many of the decisions you make have to do with spiritual values, not rational values. It's one of the reasons that economics was always called the dismal science, because it depended on intangibles. And that's what spiritual is, just another word for intangible. And so if you were to take theoretically two individuals, same gender, same age, same physical abilities, same everything, and watch them through 20 years of the same career trajectory with the same money, will they both necessarily end up with the same net worth? And every person intuitively realizes no, because some people can't stop themselves from spending and splurging and enjoying and indulging, and other people are disciplined and can save and invest. They will have dramatically different net worths. That distinguished ability that I'm alluding to here are spiritual values, because there is no way to measure in advance whether, you know, there's no instrument that'll tell me whether the person I'm thinking of marrying is a spender or a saver. There is, other than track record, by the way. But in terms of being able to, you know, you can put an infrared thermometer up to a person's forehead and know what their temperature is. There is no instrument you can put to a person's forehead and know whether they're a person of integrity, or whether they're a person of persistence, or whether they're a loyal friend, or whether they're an optimistic person, or whether they're a spender or a saver. These are all spiritual values, and they're hugely important. And so to attempt to enlarge your financial well-being without having any understanding of intangible, some people call it emotional, some people call it psychological, but at the in the final analysis, these are spiritual characteristics that impact how well you're going to make money and how you are going to spend and invest money. These are all, and again, one of the crucial things of our book, that my wife and I worked for many years on together, called The Holistic You, integrating your family and your faith and your finance and your friendship and your fitness. The central feature of that is understanding how these all interact with one another and how progressing in one imparts a huge propulsive force to the others. And that really is perhaps the biggest secret of Jewish financial success, understanding that, like mountain climbing, if you draw a straight line from where you are to the summit and try and walk up that straight line, you will die on the way. But the way to the summit very often looks odd. You're doing a circuitous route. You're heading off to the left, and then you're heading off to the right. You may even circle around to the other side of the mountain. But the correct way to most safely and most reliably reach the summit is not always intuitive. And so it is that the avenue to financial success, just focus exclusively on finance, it worked for a very tiny handful, a tiny minority. But for the rest of us normal people, what works is a holistic approach. And while it's obvious to see that you'd better take care of your physical fitness while you're working on your finances, it's equally true to be aware that you have to work on your friendships and your family and your faith at the same time.
So one of the things that people I think are obsessed with is these how-to, you know, where do you start? And I'm thinking of someone that is like, is a complete mess. They happen to stumble across this conversation between you and I, and they go, oh, you know, I'm in debt. My relationship with my spouse is hanging by a thread. I'm overweight. I mean, I don't go to church. I don't even know they're agnostic. They don't even know what they believe. You know, they have no friendships. They're just a mess. And so you can't tackle all of these things at once, right, Rabbi Lappin? You can't just all of a sudden go, well, I'm going to go to the gym every day. I'm going to start saving. It's not going to happen. So for that person wherever they are in their life's journey, how do they get started to take some control and start putting some of these practices into place from a behavioral science standpoint that's going to be sustainable, to where they can get started and then grow, like you said, start taking those tiny taps that are more, you know, crucial than just a big whack of I'm going to do it all at once, because that's not going to work. We know that. So how do you guide that person to just start taking control and redesigning their life into a more disciplined approach holistically to have these more positive outcomes?
Well, Jason, the answer to that is actually the value proposition of our book, The Holistic You. Because, of course, that is, you put your finger on obviously what the challenge is. And many chapters of the book are devoted to helping people work out literally an hour-by-hour, day-to-day program on a weekly basis. Because one of the key things is that even a small amount of measurable progress in one serves as a huge jolt of energy.
Agree.
And so how to modulate the effort expended so as to make sure that you get most bang for the joule, most bang for the watt of energy expended, making sure that you do get that deep inner satisfaction of accomplishment and achievement, you know, whether it's dropping a few pounds through something you do every morning, or whether it's cutting your rate of expenditure by stopping to do something that brings you very little pleasure, but which wastes a certain amount of money. And building that matrix of performance is the entire genius of ancient Jewish wisdom that we have condensed into the Holistic You book.
I can't wait to read it. I have not yet. And the reason why, so the Improve Always and Always, here's kind of the evolution of that. I had read Walter Isaacson's biography on Leonardo da Vinci, and it's where I first heard the story of, first of all, the architect Vitruvius and how he wanted to make a name for himself during the the reign of Augustus, and he started his career in architecture. And then from that, there were all these quote unquote Vitruvian men that were drawn, but it was Da Vinci who tried to, for the first time ever, draw the perfectly proportioned human, which was Vitruvian Man. And that's what the Vitruvian Man is. I mean, he measured from the forehead to the nose to the chin. Everything is supposed to be in perfect proportion. And that's where that served as a muse for me. Because in my life, I'd probably chase, one time I'd chase health, one time I'd chase finances, one time I'd chase career, one time I'd, I just realized that, look, you can't be one dimensional. We are a holistic being. And so it sounds to me like, and that's whenever I started the Vitruvian Project, which led to this podcast. And so that's why what you're saying resonates, I think, so much to me. So let's go through, take me through that, the book kind of as a how-to to reach that Vitruvian, that perfect proportion, which I know we'll never reach perfection. I don't want to suggest that we should, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to be, always obtaining as close or as near to excellence as possible, I guess, for a better word than perfection. So what is the utility value of the book in taking people through that journey, and how is it laid out? How are the stories given? Is it through proverb? Is it through just ancient wisdom and daily practical application? How do you use this book on a daily basis for someone that wants to actually get better in all ways?
Yeah. Well, as a rabbi and as a member of the Jewish people, it's always been important to be thoroughly practical and very, very focused on exactly what will bring about the specific results. And one essence of it, which perhaps chips away just a little bit at the Isaacson picture of Leonardo da Vinci, and comes a little closer to the Michelangelo idea of how to sculpt.
Mm-hmm.
And says Michelangelo, in almost puzzlement to the person who questions how he turns a block of marble into a remarkable statue of Moses sitting in Rome. And he says, look, I don't see your problem. I don't understand your question. Moses is in there in this block of granite. Can't you see him? All I have to do is chip away all the excess stone.
I love that. I love that.
So that's helpful. Understanding that this particular dilemma, just think about this, Jason, as you may well have done in the past. We are all the product of our unique DNA. When the egg met the sperm at our original conception, our DNA fingerprint was established there and then. And it's so different and so unique from everybody else that DNA has become a very important forensic tool. Because if somebody's DNA is found at a murder site, the likelihood that that person who owns that DNA was at that site is so overwhelming that almost every court in almost every circumstance in the world accepts that as evidence. That said, what would be your guess, and I say this to our audience, what would be your guess as to whether identical twins, who you will remember are formed by exactly the same sperm and egg. Identical twins are identical because they are identical. That means even their DNA is identical. So therefore, do you think that identical twins are born with identical fingerprints or different fingerprints? Well, and if you'd say different, I'd say to you, where on earth do you think different DNA came from that one twin didn't get that the other got? What are you talking about?
That's interesting. And I would, because my initial answer would be that they would be different.
Could they possibly be?
Right, right. Good question.
And yet they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
And so, nobody knows the answer why. They actually had to invent a word, epigenetic.
Mm-hmm. Expression, right?
To suggest that, and yet nobody actually knows what epigenetics is or how it works. It's a totally made up concept in order to solve this huge problem. Because the bottom line is nobody understands how it's possible that identical twins can have different fingerprints.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
And the answer is that you have to understand that as human beings, we are partially physical and partially spiritual. I don't know what you're wearing at the moment, Jason, and I don't know if this is a video or an audio show. Your podcast that I've heard in the past were only audio.
Yeah, it'll be both, though. This one will be both.
Well, then those who are watching it will see that neither you nor I are dressed in mechanics overalls.
Correct.
And yet, we ought to be, because they are the most rational, logical garments imaginable. It's really simple. I don't know how long it took you to get dressed this morning, but it took me longer than it would have taken me to put my two legs into the set of overalls, put my arms in, reach down to the big brass zip pull by my left knee, yank it up to my right shoulder, and I'm dressed. Mm-hmm. I could do it in less time than I can describe it. And I'm covered, I'm warm, I'm protected. It's the best clothing in the whole world. You know, but what's this silly tie doing here? And how about a jacket? Really? Why? And what's more, there's a label inside this jacket I'm kind of proud of. It's a well-tailored jacket. Are these satisfying spiritual Rabbi Lappin or physical Rabbi Lappin?
You're bringing up something that I have really of late, and I'll tell you how I've described it. And I want to get your take on that while we're on it, Rabbi, because to me, that's where, whenever people say that we're living in the Matrix, and, you know, to where it's this plastic kind of false world that suggests we should drive certain cars, wear certain clothes, but who we are, if we were just at our very essence, we probably would be wearing the mechanics clothing, the cover,
of course,
right? Because then we'd be out of the Matrix. We'd be unaffected by outside forces. And so where I am, it's one of the reasons why, just so those who are listening and not watching, I'm wearing just a black sweater. I wear more black now than I've ever worn. And I've tried to, and I love clothes. I can jump right into the Matrix and swim because I love clothing. I love fine clothing. I love your suit. I love a beautiful suit, a tailored suit. But I'm trying my best to focus more on that, because I do believe that we are a vision of God. You know, I do believe we do have that DNA within us. So not to get too overly spiritualistic for the listener, but I believe that. And so I want to be more seen and more focused on that, the divinity that is within me coming out versus the materialistic. Not to say that material is bad and having nice things is bad. That's not what I'm saying at all. But am I on the right track? Am I tracking?
No, it's you're very, very sharply focused. I agree with you 100%. In fact, you opened the door to something I wouldn't have even mentioned. But since you mentioned the divinity aspect of it, to just show you how precisely on target you are, all you have to do is think for a moment. What in the book of Genesis? This is the book Bible, right? It's shaped 2,000 years of Western civilization. There is probably no more influential book in the history of the West, in the history of civilization. There's probably no book which has been printed more times. This book tells an account of how Adam and Eve are evicted from the Garden of Eden. Do you remember what the last action of God was before he evicted them? He made them clothing.
That's right. That's right.
God the tailor.
Because all of a sudden they understood that they were naked. So yes, yeah.
Well, it gets even a little more complicated than that, because when they discovered they were naked, do you know what they both did? Adam and Eve made for themselves clothing out of fig leaves.
They hid, right? And that's yeah, because God came to the garden and you're like, where are you? Why are you?
Yeah, precisely. And we describe some of these things in the holistic you, because the question you have to ask yourself is, that when God said, oh, I'm about to make you some nice leather outfits, Adam and Eve should have said, oh, don't worry, God, we've got these really cool green clothing. We're good.
Right.
You know, we got these nice fig leaves and no problem.
And so why didn't that happen? Why was that not enough?
It wasn't enough because simply putting fig leaves over your genitals is not what clothing is all about. And the idea that clothing is tailored is a divine act. I'm just using your words. You're exactly right.
Okay.
And furthermore, in the original Hebrew of the text, in the Lord's language, one of the things that becomes evident, which is not clear in the English translation, is that when Adam and Eve covered themselves with fig leaves, they both made exactly the same article, basically a loincloth. When God made them leather clothing, they were not unisex. He made explicitly a feminine outfit for Eve and a masculine looking outfit for Adam. And so this falls into the F of family in our book, right? Because I said family includes every aspect of sexual interaction.
Yes.
And understanding the enormous potential for creativity that comes from sexual polarity.
So, and I think that's one of the things too that, and you may want to, I'd like to get you to kind of unpack this. So without going down the whole rabbit trail of gender and alternate lifestyles or whatever the in vogue vernacular is of the day, it just seems that there's certain things that going back all the way to, from a divine design and an approach to it, there's a reason why, I mean, just going mechanically speaking, things work. That family, there would be no family were it not the way you describe it. And so it's just, you can go against that, but then what happens is you have to turn society on its ear to get it to accept. I think that's what we're seeing a lot of right now. It's beyond acceptance. It's like, no, you've got to turn everything on its ear just to make it work the way you want it to work. And it seems to me like when there's that kind of struggle to make something work that, and I know I'm very simple in my approach, but I'm just like that ought to be a signal that something's not lining up the way it should, because otherwise it wouldn't be so complicated and it wouldn't have been sustainable for 2,000 years back whenever, if you didn't agree with someone, you just cut their head off or kill them. You didn't have to conform like you do today, I guess. I mean, unless you get kicked out of the tribe, but I don't know. It just seems like what I'm seeing that you're saying is like, there's this fundamental approach to the way we have evolved as a species, but it happened not because of biblical doctrine, but more because the things that you're talking about, faith, family, finance, all these things, is because it works. It's just the way it was designed. Am I on to you?
Anyone would think we'd spend 2 hours preparing this conversation beforehand, because, you know, once again, you have drilled down to the absolute essence, and you're exactly right. If I had to describe our book, The Holistic You, in one sentence, I would say it is the reliable, revelatory guide to how the world really works, with the word really in capital letters. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And one of the drawbacks that intellectuals have, Jason, can I ask you a question?
Most certainly.
Do you own any tools?
Oh, yes.
Do you like your tools?
Sure. I'm not good with them, but I like them. I'm thankful I have them.
Do you like fixing something occasionally?
Oh, sure. It feels good.
Yeah. The thing about tools is that they keep you linked or anchored to reality. Because if you apply too much force to a bolt, you'll strip the threads. That'll teach you that there's such a thing as too little force and too much force. More isn't always better. Intellectuals are people who spend almost no time with things and most of their time with ideas. And the wonderful thing, or the terrible thing about ideas, is they are infinitely elastic. You can stretch them to fit almost anything. But anybody knows, anyone who uses tools, anybody who is around things, knows that if you try and if you put too much stress on a piece of wood, it'll crack. But there's no such thing as too much stress on an idea.
That is, you know, oh man, you just described that fantastically. I love the idea that academics spend too much time with ideas and not enough time with tools, and the elasticity of those ideas can bend till we break. I'm watching a documentary right now about Stalin and Lenin, or it's actually the beginning of Leninism, and it talks about how whenever Lenin was essentially exiled and cast out, that's all he did was think and theorize and write and theorize and think until we know how that turned out. And I think that's the thing that and because you and I will be people, I believe that I've got an audience that's pretty broad in their thinking, but there's probably some people that are further to the left, that are further to the right. Some have no idea, but in the wrong hands, or whatever hands that this conversation would come into, people would call you and I, even though I'm a Christian, you're a Jew, we're religious zealots, we're bigots, we're too conservative, we're behind the times. And it's a shame, because honestly, what you're saying, Rabbi, at least this is in my heart, if someone were to ask me about some of these topics we're talking about and the way the world works, and like if I were talking to my own daughters, who I love more than anything in this world, you know, and my wife, I would always want to suggest to them the way to properly use the tool, the way to properly fix the thing that's broke, or to maintain it for their own good so that it would be of service when they needed it, so that things would work in their proper order. So I got to believe, having not read your book, that essentially it's gently and lovingly saying, look, if you want to take care of your marriage and your finances and who you are as a holistic being, then these are the ways you do it. And it's not to beat you over the head and say that you're wrong for this, I hate you for this, I'm fearful of your behavior in this way. I'm just trying to show you this is what works. And it also goes back to what you said very early in the conversation. No, not everyone can be an NFL player. Not everyone can be a professional athlete or Brad Pitt. But you know what? Tom Brady, with a lesser mind, would not have been the greatest quarterback of all time. He did not have the athletic ability. He was just, he had enough to where whenever he applied the principles of discipline, hard work, and everything he did, he became the greatest of all time. But since none of us, so good news, folks, nobody's going to ask you to be in the NFL or Major League Baseball, just because you weren't born, like I was not born with Warren Buffett's IQ, as you mentioned earlier, or Bill Gates, that is for sure. But what I have learned is that by practicing, and not to say that I've attained any form of, you know, real success or mastery, but I can say that whenever I have been focused on maintaining discipline, maintaining good health, loving my wife, cherishing my wife, raising up my children in the way they should go, in these things, it has yielded fruit. It has always worked. I have never had to have a conversation. Like, I would never come to you as a rabbi and say, you know what, Rabbi, here's the deal. I have really been saving my money. I have really been spending it prudently. I exercise. I maintain what I eat. I don't eat too much. And my wife, I tell her I love her. I adore her. And she knows I cherish her. She knows that I cherish her above all else. And my daughters, I love them. And you know what? Everything just sucks. Nothing's working. I'm broke. I'm unhealthy. I've got a bad relationship and my daughters hate me. That's never been the case. But now in those times in my life, whenever I've gone contrary to that, where I have focused too much on money, I've been too vain with my health or something like that, I could probably tell you, you know, Rabbi, things aren't going too well. And so I just hope that people hear this message from you and I, for that matter, and they realize that this isn't about some sort of righteous indignation or self-righteous behavior, but it's just like saying, you know, the holistic you is one that just works. It's like, it's using the tools that were meant to be used in a practical way, and not stripping the bolt. It's or picking up a hammer when what you need is a screwdriver. What we're doing is we're saying, I mean, am I getting the gist of this book that I have not read, but I can't wait to get my hands on?
Yes, very much so. Of course, that is the point. exactly right. And recognizing that the remarkable message of the fingerprints of twins, to go back to that idea, is the idea of human uniqueness. Understanding from the Edenic story we touched on that men and women are different. Now, you can use a hammer instead of a screwdriver, or you can use a wrench instead of a needle-nose plier, and you can tamper with ideas as much as you like, and you can try and indoctrinate young people to believe that there are no differences between men and women beyond the plumbing. And then you wonder why they struggle with marriages. Why are there fewer marriages than ever before? You mentioned earlier, why is fertility, even in the United States of America, down to well below replacement level? It's down to about 1.6 at the present time. What is going on? Why is this wrong? Well, because you are intellectually manipulating people into ideas that have nothing to do with reality and how the world really works. And the truth is, any open-minded, intellectually honest individual who has ever lived with a person of the opposite sex knows immediately that in addition to the absolutely delightful physical distinctions, there are actually spiritual distinctions. Now, if you don't like the spiritual word, then call them emotional and psychological. I don't care what you call them, but just recognize that money, making money, means something entirely different to a man than it does to a woman. When industries left the area of Pittsburgh, when the steel industry went, when manufacturing left the Northeast, and money problems multiplied, if there's one thing we've got good stats on in the United States of America, it's on medical health, because your stats are taken every single time you go to the doctor. And so we know that without a shadow of a doubt, sexual dysfunction strikes in significant force when an area where industries close down and finance declines. We also know remarkably that sexual dysfunction occurs in the case of financial stress among men, not among women. Now, that's important to know, that money means something quite different to a man than it does to a woman. You've got to know that if you want to live successfully. You've got to be able to look at the indoctrination in the eye. You've got to look at the propaganda in the eye. You've got to look at the liars in the eye and say, I'm not going to let your rubbish ruin my life. I am going to stick to how reality works.
I want to ask you something because I want to give people a reason to completely just, you know, throw their phone out the window or really get mad at you, Rabbi. So what are those differences? What is the difference between a man's view of money and a woman's view? I want to really stir people up here.
Well, it's again, I'm keeping an eye on our time, and I think we sort of are beginning to run out. So I've got to be careful not to embark on something too complex. But again, I explain it very fully in the book, and here's a little bit of what I say, Jason. To understand the difference between what money means to men and what money means to women, we have to look at a very, very strange phenomenon. And that is the phenomenon of the baculum. And let me tell you what a baculum is, because the overwhelming majority of our listeners are extremely unlikely to know what a baculum is. And that's okay, because it's not covered in most high school courses on biology. But a baculum is something that almost every mammal except men have. And that is, the best description of it is a penile bone. At the time when it is appropriate for mating and procreative purposes, a rigid extension extends into the male organ, providing the rigidity necessary for penetration and impregnation. I'm trying to use language that any children listening will not be.
Understood.
But I'm clear, aren't I?
Absolutely.
Okay. Don't you think evolution should have given that to men as well? Wouldn't you have thought that there'd be a huge advantage to a man who can never, ever need a little blue tablet made by Pfizer?
Most certainly.
And yet, evolution has failed to provide men with a bacula.
Hmm.
And so the essence of a relationship between a man and a woman is apparently not procreative. That's part of it, obviously, from a biological perspective. But if it was purely procreative, then surely men would have been equipped with a baculum as well as horses and elephants and dolphins and every other mammal, including most primates, by the way. So it's a very, very interesting thing. There's a fundamental difference. And so going from there, we make another discovery that, again, with the exception of a very small number of high-tech era black swans, the overwhelming majority of highly successful men are married.
Yep.
So what is it about the presence of a woman in my life that makes me more likely to succeed financially? That's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Here, now I'm going to put it a slightly different way. You wanted me to irritate people. I hate doing that. I hate irritating people. I can't help inadvertently
doing
it sometimes.
But I'm blaming you. You brought it out in me today, Rabbi. I hate to do it, but I'm blaming you because you brought it out in me.
Okay, fine. Because you know what? As Alexander Solzhenitsyn said when he came out of Russia in the 70s, sometimes telling the truth makes people angry.
The Gulag Archipelago is one of my favorite. Everyone should read that if they want to. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And so part of the reality is that having a few dollars lets a man expand his dating pool, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But paradoxically, having a few dollars reduces a woman's dating pool.
Yes.
Because when a woman meets a man, among the important things she wants to know about is, how's he doing financially? How ambitious is he?
Mm-hmm.
Now, stupid men denigrate women who think like that as gold diggers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a self-protective mechanism for losers.
Agreed. Because
as the father of six daughters, and I gather you have a daughter or two.
Two, yeah.
You will teach your daughters, as I teach mine, to be very alert to the financial situation of the men they meet, because I don't see finances as an irrelevant sideshow at all. It tells me a whole lot about a man. It tells me, for one thing, if he has the ability to save and invest, can he defer gratification, or has he got to spend everything on the latest gadget or the latest pleasure? Right. So the financial condition of a man tells me a lot about a man, tells a woman a lot about a man. It is impossible to make money if you do not have the ability to relate comfortably to other men. Because you have to either get a job, you have to progress in a job. And, you know, what is the difference between doctors who make a lot of money and doctors who struggle to keep their practices open? It has nothing to do with what medical school they went to. It has nothing to do with where in their class they graduated. It has to do with their people skills.
Yeah. Yep.
And so the financial status of a man tells a lot about the man. And so if the man has a few dollars, yeah, he has more choice in the dating and mating pool. But if a woman has a few dollars, well, something has changed. Because one of the absolute worst feelings for a man is impotence. Again, going back to the financial success of the Pfizer pharmaceutical company, it's one of the worst things. Now, impotence is very closely related to dispensability.
Mm.
mm-hmm. not being needed. A man needs to be needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why, and I hate to say this because invariably there's going to be somebody listening in this situation. And so let me say, yes, there are exceptions, but in general, marriages where the woman has more money than the man do not last. They don't last very long at all. Marriages in which the wife out-earns the husband do not last very long at all. Either she meets up and is attracted to an alpha man at work, or alternatively, he meets somebody who actually has respect for him. Because almost no woman, almost, there are exceptions, folks, there are, but almost no woman respects a man who can't earn a living. And that's one of the reasons why men who do not have jobs and who sit around wonder about why they're not finding girlfriends. And they can't bear the idea that it has a lot to do with money. And that's back to my book, The Holistic You, Family and Finance, Sex and Money, very, very close connections in very different ways for men and for women.
I cannot wait to get my hands on this book, because another thing, talking about, like, again, people's hair are going to catch on fire because you even suggest the fact that if a woman earns more money, or if she is the breadwinner in the home, that the marriage is less likely to survive. You didn't make this up. There's data to show this. Every time George suggests such a thing.
No, don't shoot the messenger. Exactly. I'm innocent.
That's what we're seeing right now. And that's why I think this book is going to be so beneficial. Although, you know, we live in a society where down is up, up is down. It's Misfit Island. It doesn't matter what the data suggests. It doesn't matter what history suggests. Yeah. We want, again, the academics are just pulling that elasticity as far as they can. And unfortunately, a lot of the useful idiots are jumping right in and going, oh, I like what it says. You mean I don't have to exercise? You mean I don't have to be prudent with my money? You mean I don't have to follow these tried and true ways of living? I don't have to do that. And why am I not successful? And again, I think, and we'll kind of wrap it up with this, Rabbi, I could talk to you all day.
I'm enjoying talking with you very much, Jason. You're so on top of this. It's an absolute pleasure. But sadly, I have another interview starting in about, 10 minutes now.
Well, let's give you some time to catch your breath. I just want to say this. You have an open invitation. We have more to unpack here.
Yes, we do.
And the final point I wanted to make is everything we're talking about, the people that refuse to read this book are the same people who are, even though we live in the single greatest time of the human experience, are more miserable than ever. There is a correlation, folks. Whenever you just kind of butt up against reality, you butt up against the things that the way we were designed to operate, it's going to be a miserable existence. And I think that's what we're seeing. So I think your book could be an antidote for those who still have enough of an open mind that are seeking to go, why are things so good and I'm so miserable? I think The Holistic You would be a great place to start. So where can people find you, Rabbi, to follow you, to get your YouTube videos and to order the book? How do people stay in contact with you?
Well, of course, on social media, naturally, I'm everywhere. But my website is rabbidaniellappin.com. Rabbidaniellappin, LAPIN.com. And let me ask you this, Jason. Does a certain large international online bookstore advertise on your show?
No, they do not.
Well, then I'm not going to give them free advertising by mentioning their name. But obviously, my book is available wherever you buy books online.
But they can get it on your website?
Yes, it's available on the website as well.
Okay. I will have the links to that, because just folks, just so you know, whenever you publish a book, that helps the author. So if you want to support, am I correct, right? So Rabbi, I highly suggest, so I will take care of that. I'm on it. So Rabbi, I want you to get to your next interview. I am so grateful for you making this time. Please do come back and shalom, sir.
Shalom to you, Jason. And again, if I may compliment your podcast, and if I can compliment your interviewing style, as you can imagine, I do a lot of interviews, and some of them, I just keep looking at my watch. I just wanted to get to the end. It's grueling and arduous. But as you can tell, talking with you has been an absolute pleasure. It's been very stimulating. And for that, you deserve considerable credit. It's a lot harder to do than people think. So thanks for being so good at it.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate that. I'm honored. Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi. Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Well, that does it for this episode of The Jason Wright Show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been a Texas Titan Media production. Fourth Wall did the music. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Please consider going out to jasonwrightnow.com and signing up for the Vitruvian Letter. Also, please go out to iTunes. It takes like 30 seconds to just leave us a 5-star rating. It does wonders for the podcast. I would be so grateful. And with that, until we meet again, go crush it and endeavor to improve always in all ways. I'm out.